Well, welcome to Current Yield, Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air. I am Jim Grant, and with me, as always, is the great deputy editor of Grant's, Evan Lorenz. Evan is not here, but he is virtually here. Good morning, Evan.
Good morning, Jim.
And we have hanging out in Singapore, where it is not 9 in the morning, but rather 10 in the evening, is David Dredge. And David, good evening to you.
Good morning over there, guys. Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. It's not everybody who's going to hop on the phone at 10 p.m. to talk about volatility. And Henry French is making sure that our voices are mellifluous. So I am going to begin. Ordinarily, Evan and I ordinarily begin by bantering about current events. You know, say something about scam coins and the most venal administration in the history of North America. You know, stuff like that. But I want, in view of the sacrifices that our guest is making with respect to time, I want to begin by introducing him properly. And here goes. Okay, so I'm going to quote, besides the CV, which is formidable, and I'll touch on that one moment, but here is how David Dredge introduced himself to the attendees at the Grants Conference two autumns ago, October 2023. Quote, I'm not trying to make money. Evan, how many of our speakers have ever admitted that?
Before the fact or after the fact?
Correct. Okay, resume.
I would say about zero.
Right. Resume the quote. I'm only on the defensive side. Okay, so, and he continued, by way of elaboration, I don't have a view, I don't have a forecast, I simply buy cheap volatility. Now, this is from the man who founded something called Convex Strategies. That'll give you a clue about what he does for a living, and who earlier in his business life built and ran Asian and global EM trading businesses for RBS, Bankers Trust, and Bank America. And while procuring an MBA at the University of California, David Dredge studied under none other than Janet Yellen. And in a moment, we will ask him what he has chosen to unlearn from that experience. But one of the most striking things about his CV is that he sits, I think it's still currently, on the Markets Committee of the Monetary Authority of Singapore. That's pretty good for a guy from Utah.
And the longest serving member of said Markets Committee, I believe.
Oh, goodness. Well, nothing like a little longevity. Myself happen to have not had a promotion in 42 years, David. Hey, David, the world is nothing if not interesting. And your business is volatility. Is this not high cotton for you?
It's we're busy. I'll say that. And it concerns us because, you know, we're in the business of providing highly efficient, negatively correlating asymmetric risk so that our clients, our investors can, you know, go out and each of them become individually the next Warren Buffett or the next Stan Druckenmiller, allow them to proceed with confidence in the uncharted worlds of risk, knowing that they've got really, really good brakes on the car, allowing them to drive with confidence and aggression when opportunity presents. So we always give a little concern when things start to get a little shaky for fear that the opportunities that we pursue in the markets, the opportunities provided by us by the supply and demand dynamics of volatility markets, start to sort of jitter away from us and people become reluctant to provide us the insurance type structures that we covet. So we're on high alert this week because we've kind of gone from Monday, where we could have hedged the entire world, to today, not so many people calling trying to sell us what we'd like to buy.
So 2020 and 21 were, in fact, high cotton times, right?
Yeah, well, obviously, the dislocations at the tail end of large risk buildups, so 2019, which then created a fragility in the system that when it caught a spark, well, in hindsight, they like to name the sparks. They'll call that one COVID. But in reality, the risk was the buildup of fragility leverage in the system prior to COVID coming along. Yeah. And then, of course, again in 2022 and 2021 with the sort of supposedly surprised inflation, and then 2022 with the unconscionable increase in policy rates that the policymakers who had promised to keep rates low forever, to wait for the whites of the eyes and average inflation targeting, chose suddenly to raise interest rates all around the world. And those sorts of things are where we hope that the opportunities that we've constructed provide some protection, some comfort, some P&L offset for our investors, which indeed has been the case. And in between those periods, the additional risk-taking assets they own have done extraordinarily well. So it's been good for everybody.
Yeah.
Where's the drug tender today that might become a financial fire tomorrow?
Well, and I know you guys read some of my notes that I put up on the website each month. I suspect many of you are familiar with some of my pictures of volatility markets and last year and how I draw little red circles about where risk builds up and pricing gets historically abnormally low, which tends to be the precursor to reflexive unwinds of that risk taking. And so you may recall that several times last year, probably starting in about April, about a year ago, I was putting as an example of that, the way to look at endogenous risk, the pricing of Euro FX butterflies or skew or convexity volatility pricing. And so I think we're seeing this week in particular, you know, the implications of the accumulation of leverage fragility in Europe with what's happening now with the currency and with the bond markets and the bond and in the shock. I mean, Jim, you're slightly longer longevity than I, but I would term the announcements from Germany this week as being some of the most stunning and extraordinary and maybe scary in my wild career.
Yes. Well, in 1990-ish, when the wall came down, the late Michael Harkins and I got together. We decided that what we ought to do is to invent a fund that would buy bonds at then prevailing rates of 9%. Because how often you got the opportunity to buy high yielding sovereign debt from a AAA issuer that is, we thought, temporarily caught with rather too much on his plate with respect to unification. Much interested in that, but that's the only comparison with respect to Germany specifically. But we at Grants have identified a first cousin to the first 6 weeks or 7 weeks of Donald J. Trump, which is the first 100 days of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Then the world's hair was on fire. Roosevelt calls in the gold and institutes all these new agencies and brings in a guy from the Cornell Ag School to reorganize the world's monetary affairs. And people likened it to Columbus, who didn't know where he was headed, didn't know what he had arrived at when he got there, and didn't know where he had been when he got home. There was a sense of overall confusion and disorientation, much the same as pertains today. But tell us, you know, one would have expected, and perhaps ought still to expect, David, some sort of kaboom in asset markets that have been conditioned to expect none of the recent volatility, certainly in regard to rates. Leverage has been built up, certainly in Japan. We have a 10-year JGB yielding the most since 2010 or something. So are you standing around some days with your hands over your ears expecting the explosion that has not yet come?
Not really. Is the good fortune of what we do is we get to see a pretty good picture of if and when the fire starts and starts to spread, the contagion, the correlation that's really the big risk in the system. Because we're fortunate enough to get to see in what we do where the endogenous risk, where the clumps of dry brush and trees, where the leverage and markets, the implicit leverage and volatility markets is built, we're usually pretty well expecting it when the big burst of fire comes. So rarely does it cause a shock to us. You mentioned Japan, and I talked about this on the stage at your absolutely glorious 40th anniversary conference, that one of the best times I've ever had. And I sort of told my story there of some of the big imbalances that had built and built in the system. And those imbalances invariably are, and you know, Jim, you speak about this as eloquently as anybody ever heard, are imbalances created when some unnatural force, usually a central bank or a government, imposes their will against the market's own natural functioning. And, you know, in the world I sit in and live in, and I talked about it on stage at your conference, you know, some of the biggest, longest imposers of unnatural force against the natural functioning of markets have been Japan, Bank of Japan, zero interest rates and QE and a scale and longevity and relative size to the economy, unlike anything the world's ever seen for decades and decades now. I was conveniently in Japan working as a young man back in 1991 at the very peak of the Japanese bubble as it was all just starting. And of course, the government accommodated by that central bank, as all governments have in recent years, but uniquely Japan running up 260% of debt to GDP. And now as they consider the prospect of unwinding that, as their efforts, justifiably or not, seem to be generating the inflation they've so long desired. And of course, right next door, just across the waters from Japan, you have China, who after the GFC became virtually the single contributor of credit impulse to the world and has created more money in credit and absolute scale than, than Japan did in the 80s or the U.S. did prior to GFC. And all the while holding their currency pegged and maintaining capital controls. And so that proliferation of onshore money creation and credit creation behind a currency that the market hasn't been allowed to adjust and determine the value. The market isn't even allowed to decide who gets to buy and sell it. Has created very, very large imbalances. Many of the imbalances that the new president in your country, my country, is challenged with his concerns around tariffs and the like. And then, of course, the other one that is most in the news this week and maybe most weeks of late is Europe, where you've now 24 years from 2000, the implementation of the euro, an experiment in an internal pegged currency, pulling all these diverse countries together and telling everyone we're going to manage an average interest rate for everybody based upon some average R-star assessment, some bogus nonsense known as natural rate or neutral rate, based upon the average inflation. And everybody's going to build and build and build imbalances as we trade with each other and capital flows move around. And we'll never let an internal currency adjustment take place to rebalance them. And we're going to keep doing that indefinitely. And we're going to impose it no matter what under the guidelines of the great comrade Draghi, as I like to call him, whatever it takes. I can't help but wonder if this week we're finding out some of the longer term implications of what it's going to take. So I still think, as I talked about on your stage, those three great big global imbalances are the major players. And it's very possible that your new friend and administration in America, the Trump administration, sure seems like he's a spark looking for clumps of dry brush.
What, if anything, sets everything alight? Because just looking from a stateside perspective, we have all of these things that I would have expected to cause problems in a sell-off. We have the explosion of one-day to expiry options. We have a proliferation of double and triple leverage single stock ETFs, record high margin debt. And we also have extreme just risk-taking behavior. If you look at cryptocurrencies, and we've had a little correction in U.S. stock prices. And the amazing thing to me is how orderly it has been.
Well, I think, Evan, the way we talk about it in our world is uncapitalized tails. And in many of the examples you just gave, Bitcoin, maybe the most extreme example, there's just not a lot of leverage. The participants in the crypto market, in the Bitcoin market, the biggest of them, generally are risking their own money. And when they take down leverage to do that, they get wiped out, stopped out, cut out. We had the meltdowns of, one of the largest, some of the largest, certainly then at the time, largest crypto exchange, FTX, and the system carried on because the system itself is not systemically risky. Historically, and again, Jim's more of an expert on this than I am, systemic risk flows out of the banking system because that's where the biggest leverage has been. It's when you've got to come in and bail out the banks, where you have runs on banks, where banks who even to this day, post GFC, run 30 plus times levered with all kinds of nonsense like zero risk-weighted assets and hold to maturity, accrual accounting, no market accounting. And you can see supposedly reputable, highly regulated banks like Silicon Valley Bank going out of business because they owned U.S. treasuries. Or you can see the unthinkable of Credit Suisse, a G-SIB, a globally systemically important bank, going out of business when they've guaranteed us that these 30 banks have extra buffers and extra oversight and extra stuff. So the risk is still out there. I think, you know, when Jim and I have talked about this a lot over the last few years, a lot of the fears of, oh my gosh, what's going to happen when interest rates rise? When in a sense, you haven't seen much happen because the guys who own most of the bonds, banks, pension funds, insurance companies, regulated, what I would call sharp world entities, don't necessarily have to eat those losses. They just carry them forever. And so their capital that's exposed to that, other than the rare case of a Silicon Valley Bank or First Republic Bank or the various other ones, don't go away. And so there's not a forced cutting of those positions and the market doesn't erupt and we carry on. So, you know, those sensitivities are still in the system. I think right now, and again, going back to where I started this answer, you know, last year, and, you know, we talked about it and over the course of the year, in a number of markets, convexity, volatility in foreign exchange markets got extraordinarily cheap. And so as things like the euro starts to move for the first time in a very long time, that has implications possibly for where you might see further noise. Obviously, I don't think anybody, even I, had the 30 basis point one day sell off in Boons on a bingo card coming into this month.
Yeah.
So I think there are some pockets out there that worth keeping an eye on. One of the things that, you know, is obviously to my point about leverage and banking systems and stuff, you know, a lot of risk, and Jim talks about this a lot too, a lot of risk, I would argue intentionally, has been pushed out of the banks. And so this huge proliferation of private credit and non-bank financial institutions and pension funds and, you know, BlackRock's and stuff, absorbing stuff that maybe traditionally might have sat on banks' balance sheets, puts the risks of things in the hands of the actual capital owners behind it. So the losses, you know, the LDI event in the UK pension system a few years back, well, those losses are going to the pensioners. But when those losses are in the banking system, it necessitates a bailout because the banks don't have any capital to absorb the losses and the depositors are guaranteed by taxpayers. So we're still keeping an eye on it. And you know, volatility is coming back. You know, VIX is as high as it's been for a while, certainly since the events of August last year with the little first taste of a yen carry unwind and the correlation effect. But it's an interesting time.
David, where is volatility the cheapest today and where is it the most expensive?
Well, the place, again, that's been cheap for the last while, in fact, I said this on a podcast in January that 2024 was to FX volatility what 2021 was to interest rate volatility. And now we're going to have to wait and see if 2025 is to FX volatility what 2022 was to interest rate volatility. So the thing that has been really, really cheap has been FX volatility. And so much so that I could have, like I said, hedged. You know, if any major sovereign wealth fund had called me up and wanted to slap on a hedge for the whole portfolio on Monday this week, I probably could have done it. Not so much so today. So FX has been where it has been extraordinarily cheap, and in particular around Europe. Euro, sterling, the crosses, euro sterling, euro Swiss, euro Czech, euro, anything related to that explicit peg or quasi peg has been incredibly cheap. And obviously this week is starting to get a little bit shaky. You know, extreme back end interest rate volatility has been cheap. And this is something we talked about when I was in town a couple of years back. You know, that risk of the bear steepener still exists out there in interest rate curves, particularly in Europe. And so not surprisingly, it was the one when a shock occurred that you had a pretty good steepening event and some pretty extreme volatility in the back end of government bond markets and swap curves and bond swap spreads, some pretty good movements there. You know, it has, you know, places where it's not been particularly cheap. It has certainly not been cheap to own downside protection in U.S. equities. The perpetual costliness of skew, downside put skew in S&P has been a big problem for people who have wanted to use S&P volatility as a hedge. Now, on the contrary, one of the cheapest things going back to July of last year and really through till even December, but really July and September, was upside volatility or upside convexity, the skew of convexity, vol of vol, in S&P. That has also been the case more recently in Europe. And of course, you see what's happened to European stocks. Once they start going up into that market that has been, let's say, for whatever reason, selling calls to mitigate risk or covered call writing or selling calls to buy puts because people are worried about it. And so once it starts moving into that, it, you know, creates, it accentuates the underweighting of people's holdings in a place like Europe. And then you throw in the anticipation of $1 trillion of fresh fiscal stimulus, and the European market does pretty good. A pretty good start of the year, plus 20%-ish across most of Europe. Japan is its own little unique world and has not, since the probably last time we talked in person, you know, Japan vol was quite attractive, equity vol. And then you had extreme moves, the 12% down day on August 5th, and it hasn't really been that cheap since. But there's been good supply of complex of the good old power reverse dual currency and FX, and so FX vol has been reasonably attractive in Japan. Interest rate vol is still attractive in Japan, and the front end, the back end has been allowed to move, and that's sort of repriced again way back in 2022, but shorter dated front end vol still hasn't repriced. There's still very strong belief, as we talk all the time, that the Bank of Japan will be very slow in their adjustments towards some sort of rational neutral rate of their own.
David, in your writings, you make the point that if investors allocate a portion of their portfolios to volatility as an asset class, they can hold more risky assets like stocks with fewer drawdowns and get better long-term performance. You liken this to if you have better brakes in your car, you can drive a little bit faster. How do investors get long volatility? Is this something they can do passive, or do they require a manager like you always hunting out for the next cheap thing in order to hedge the book?
Noting that I have an obvious bias in that question, you know, running the hedge side, the liability side. So in a sense, right, we're a store of liquidity, and we're doing it in sort of highly convex, asymmetric liquidity on steroids form. But it requires a higher level of work and effort than just than traditional investing. Investing, the relationship with time, Evan, is sort of the answer. Investing, you do most of your work before you make the investment, and you find the right company or the right structure, and then you put your money in, and then you go look for the next one to go and diversify your portfolio. And you hope that over time, time is your friend, you accrue the dividend, the capital gains, the coupon, whatever it is. But in the hedging world, on the other side of that, where you're buying insurance, you're buying protection, time is your enemy. Every day our portfolio would get, you know, shorter duration and lose sensitivity. And we need to offset that, and we need to work. So it's a very difficult job for somebody to do as a side job if they want to do it well. And it's, you know, it's a very different skill set than simply than a traditional investing opportunity or a traditional investing activity. So if you have the means, if you're a big institutional investor, you certainly should go and find guys like me, guys like my team, our team here, and as many of us as you can find, because it is, as my numbers, you know, my examples always show, the most valuable thing you can do to your long-term compounding path. Sadly, if you're a retail investor, it's very difficult for you to access actively managed professional people. Now, increasingly, guys are trying to embed those in ETFs as the rules have changed in the US. You have guys like our friends, our mutual friends at Simplify, Harley Bassman and Mike Green, that are doing specific sort of simplified, not to steal their words, strategies embedded in ETFs, but they're doing that more as sort of a one-off trade. This one is for hedging interest rates going up. This one is for hedging equities for going down. It's not a ongoing, relentless, constant, find every opportunity that's out there, keep it going forever and ever and ever thing. But it is a, you know, as I say, the good thing about convexity, even doing it poorly will improve your performance, will improve your outcomes.
David, what do people in Singapore, the financial community in Singapore, what does the financial community in Singapore think of the new Trump administration and its policies one day to the next?
That's a complicated question. Singapore, you know, everywhere in the world is diverse. Many places in the world might be diverse in a sort of bipolar way. Singapore, the financial community here, the whole country here, is more diverse than anywhere. It's a pure melting pot. You know, it's got one of the largest share of population of foreigners because the place has grown and grown and grown with the influx of guys like me and all sorts of foreigners and Japanese and Europeans and Australians and Koreans and Indians and Chinese. And so there's a very mixed view here. I think, you know, the general view of Singapore is a very large believer in open markets. That's sort of Singapore's path to success, was looking around and saying, all of our much, much, much bigger neighbors are all protectionists and all have capital controls and all have kinds, all sorts of rules and restrictions for trade and movement of money. Why don't we become the open port? Literally, initially for goods, but then eventually for financial services, in the midst of this enormous Southeast Asian block of really, really big countries that are all closed. And everything will flow through us, will become the sort of clearing center for the region. And that has served Singapore very, very well. So I think Singapore naturally is concerned by things that are protectionist, that are restrictions to free trade. Singapore has a particularly challenging, as does I think most of the world, fence line that they walk upon, where they clearly have a long-term security relationship with the United States, but over years have grown deeper and deeper economic ties with China. And so they have to tread carefully and make sure they're not trotting on the wrong side of sanctions and requirements and what can and cannot be done. And the more those get expanded, the more complicated it gets for people here who have very deep business relationships with China, but very strong relationships with the U.S., particularly from the security side. So it's a complication. Obviously, the complications across the world, the big complication, again, sort of the theme of my speech, my Hunger Games analogy, who's going to buy all the bonds? This sort of fight to the last man of who can issue all the bonds as fiscal profligacy goes one way and one way only, has been a huge boon for Singapore, because the one place that doesn't need your money is Singapore. And so the place everybody wants to put their money is Singapore, because people don't have fear of confiscation, debasement, capital controls here, because Singapore is not indebted. And so, you know, it, in a sense, has been good for business, the fact that it's not hard and to look around and say, geez, I can see concerns that there's going to be more QE or debasement in that market, or there's going to be restrictions and capital controls and financial repression in that market. So if I'm a big wealthy family office or corporation or institution, maybe I'll park my excess money in Singapore, who doesn't seem to have any incentive to confiscate somebody else's wealth. It's still a very booming place, Jim, and such a fascinating place. And business is good. You know, they have to fight. You know, when I came here originally in 1987, it was a cheap place. Now it's arguably, by most measures, the most expensive place in the world. Their success comes with a price, and that price is, to some extent, inflation and cost of living. But they do a good job.
Well, Dave, what I was driving at was there anything like a freak out going on in Singapore over this?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. Singapore is all business all the time.
Okay. Evan, you were saying?
Yeah. David, you've been around for more than one cycle and you're a student of history. When you kind of look at the buildup of risk that could lead to problems and the way it's being priced, is there any analog over the course of kind of your career or just your reading that this moment resembles?
Yeah, I've been talking about it a lot because people keep asking me questions as we've been going through the various processes of, you know, crazy accommodation in 2020 and then sort of shockingly aggressive 25, 50, 75, 75 rate hikes in 2022 and then Fed cuts last year as stock markets are at all-time high and financial conditions are loose, leading to 10-year yields going up as the Fed's cutting and stock market skyrocketing. And I wrote a note a couple months ago titled Deja Vu, because it reminds me so much of the you know, the mass liquidity provision in the early 90s from Alan Greenspan and Bank of Japan post the Japan bubble burst and the extreme, you know, surge in markets in 93 that led to the surprise rate hikes in 94, which was the last time, you know, prior to 2022 that Jim and I got to see 50 and 75 basis point rate hikes. And then the quick reversal of that after China devalued and Mexico had to have its IMF bailout and the Fed cutting rates in the second half of 95, even as stock markets are at all-time highs and financial conditions were loose, eventually leading to this, you know, the buildup of risk that would become the Asian crisis as the dollar just kept charging forward and U.S. equities kept charging forward and back-end U.S. interest rates stayed higher and higher. And that sort of blowing of liquidity that was the provision turned into a suction of liquidity. And the U.S., you know, sort of pulled capital out of everywhere in the world and had, you know, the U.S. had its best five-year period, certainly in my career, in terms of equities from 95, 96, 97, 98, 99. S&P compounded at 28.6%, was up 20% plus every year for 5 years. And the dollar went up 50% in that window. And that process of sort of sucking all the capital back out of the rest of the world, you know, blew up Asia, blew up Russia, blew up LTCM, blew up correlations that created these problems, resulted in the sort of consolidation of my old investment banking firm, Bankers Trust, into Deutsche Bank and Salomon Brothers into Citibank and First Boston into Credit Suisse and JP Morgan into Chase Manhattan. And so, you know, I keep having some deja vus about this sort of blow and suck dynamic of capital. Now, maybe, you know, the other thing that's deja vu, and again, Jim will be a bigger expert on this than I am, that 95 through 99 window is one of the, well, it's the only, again, window in my career where the U.S. shrunk their deficit, where you actually went to a surplus and debt to GDP declined, which was another aspect of pulling capital out of the rest of the world as attractively yielding to sort of Jim's story about Boons. The last time I remember saying long-dated U.S. Treasuries are a good buy was at the very end of 1999, when, you know, I think 30-year Treasury was near 7%, and the U.S. was running a surplus. And so all of that kind of reminds me a little bit of what's going on now. Doesn't mean it's going to play out the same, but I, you know, I laugh all the time when people say, oh, I went back and did a look back, and every time the S&P had back-to-back 20% up years, as it has had now in 23 and 24, it always goes down. Except for 1995 to 1999. And of course, people in the U.S. remember those years as like, well, it was great, right? Of course, it terminated in the dot-com bubble, and then eventually you got the NASDAQ crash, et cetera. But 95 to 99 was glory years. But they forget that in the rest of the world, it was probably certainly the largest volatility events I've ever been through. And I've been through everything since, you know, the 87 crash. But, you know, the meltdowns in the Asian markets, you know, dwarf the market scale of market meltdowns in 2008. So it is an interesting analogy. I'd be interested to hear what Jim thinks about, you know, like-minded analogies and whether my deja vu of that late 90s period rings true to him at all.
Oh, a little bit. But David, rather than merely echo your excellent description of what had been and what may be and what could be, I do want to hear about Professor Yellen, what you learned and what you have chosen to unlearn.
That is a great question, Jim. You know, I'm a simple boy from Utah.
We've noticed that.
Who did well enough to find his way into graduate business school in the prestigious University of California, Berkeley, and sitting in a macroeconomic class taught by the even then renowned Janet Yellen. And this was before her central banking and treasury career. But even then, having graduated from Yale and teaching at Harvard and coming to Berkeley was already well known. But I had this constant sort of problem. I might call it common sense. I kept asking questions about the assumptions behind her models that she believed in so strongly. And every time you questioned one of her assumptions, you know, Professor Yellen, why, if your tool is interest rates, whose transmission mechanism is credit when you want to turn it up or turn it down. Why isn't credit included in as a variable in your model? And she would say, well, credit doesn't matter. And you say, well, the U.S. is the global reserve currency and the largest economy in the world. Why is your model a closed economy? It doesn't reflect interactions with the rest of the world. And her response, and Jim, I'm sure you've heard this story from other people, was always, what is your model?
Right. Yes.
Because you could argue comparative religion, but you couldn't question the premise of religion.
Yeah.
You couldn't question the premise of rational economic math. And you know, I'm quite a critic of that concept because I don't think normal market participants, normal people like me, have perfect information and the ability to calculate all probabilities looking through multi-period time horizons and calculate my decisions for my best expected utility. I think people are boundedly rational and they use some tacit knowledge and some derision heuristics to make sort of best case decisions. But I would argue what our friends in the central planning ivory towers live off of is they've sort of created for themselves in their regulatory construct of the financial industry what I call rational accounting man. And in certain markets, particularly bond markets, government bond markets, are dominated not by rational economic man or my boundedly rational man. They're dominated by rational accounting man. They're dominated by the big financial institutions who aren't managing to any sort of long-term wealth creation, retirement savings. They're managing for calendar year accounting based upon BIS regulatory capital guidelines or pension fund IAS 19 accounting rules or Solvency II and insurance. So they're making investment decisions. And I think this answers, you know, your question, Jim. Why would anybody buy negatively yielding long-dated bonds? Well, because rational economic man is getting incentivized to do so without any of the risk and consequences of destroying compounding paths for whoever's money he's actually putting into those things. And so I often talk about and wish that I could sit down with Professor Yellen someday, but I think those bridges are probably long.
You got no shot.
to say, what if we just slightly tweaked your understanding of what you're doing and that you're really just manipulating those which you have trapped inside the regulatory framework of sharp world financial institutions? And they sort of do behave that way.
Yeah. But I noticed in one of your latest pieces, Dave, that you clapped your hand on the back, figuratively speaking, of Chair Powell for a remark of his in the January press conference in which he said something to the effect of, you know, cat tails are just the way life works. And it's never, he said, quote, it's never not that way. And you said, my goodness, what a breath of fresh air. And then you proceeded to document the next two quotations that absolutely confounded and conflicted and contradicted that expression of humility about the future. So we make measured progress in this business, measured progress.
I think you'd probably agree with me on this, Jim. And I've had the great joy of knowing a number of wise economists and central bankers over the year, many of which I am friends with to this day. And I do know that there seems to be some knack of having certain knowledge and instincts that may or may not be reflected in their public statements when they're in the actual job.
Yeah.
And I think Chair Powell probably is that way. I don't know if you're aware that Chair Powell and I, though we never actually crossed paths, were colleagues at Bankers Trust once upon a time.
I did not know that. Well, David, I think it's almost bedtime for you. I'm worried about you keeping these hours. And
Easier than when I spoke on stage after the 19-hour overnight flight from Singapore.
One always marvels at Donald Trump's irrepressible vigor and energy. Trump and I are about the same age. We share a few things, but we do share approximate birthdays. And how he keeps going is a source of wonderment and sometimes a little bit of regret. But But you, for that particular week in which you were in the United States and managed to adapt and come up on the plaza stage and say your piece, and it was so well received. And anyway, you're great to do. I think you had to reschedule some things in your birthplace of Utah to get there and make excuses that were not entirely well received. So one more thanks for that event 2 years ago, David, and thank you for this evening, for you as well. It's been a joy and a pleasure to be with you.
Absolute pleasure. Always great to talk to you guys. I wish we could do it over a lunch or a refreshing beverage a little more frequently.
Wouldn't that be nice? Well, all you got to do is move about, was it 6,000 miles to the west or east or north or something? Anyway, thank you, David.
I'll let you know when I'm going to be in town. Thanks, okay. Guys.
Well, this is Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air. I'm Jim Grant, and so long for now. Talk to you soon.